what history tells us is that people who were in the land at that time, they were deemed to be savages, barbaric, tribes. Still to this day, the narrative is still going on in the media where we call the Ovaherero and Nama communities as tribes, and we call the Germans as settlers or former colonized colonial powers or something like that. You know? So already...
We have 5 seconds.
When we are just speaking... Yeah, when we are just speaking, there is no equality in that, and that already we should start to question that before we even go to any to discuss anything when it comes
and we,
to
we will come apology. Back to this issue. I want to thank you, MC Erastus and Yoko Muvangwa. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature removes State Rep. Mike Nearman for allowing armed demonstrators into the State House. New state law requires communities to allow houseless people to camp on public property, and the Department of Justice will investigate Trump-era spying on Democratic lawmakers and journalists. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 11th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon State Representative Mike Nearman has been expelled from the State House. The Oregon House of Representatives voted on Thursday to remove Nearman for ushering armed far-right demonstrators into the State House last December. With more on the story, it's KBOO's Jeffrey Wade.
The Oregon House of Representatives voted to expel one of its own members Thursday night, marking the first time in its 160th year history that the body voted to expel one of its own. The near-unanimous vote was 59-1 to expel Republican Mike Nearman of Independence, Oregon, following his role in allowing armed far-right demonstrators into a closed Capitol building during a special session last December. A special committee voted unanimously Thursday afternoon to recommend expelling him before the House convened in an evening floor session to decide the legislator's fate. On December 21, 2020, Capitol security video captured Nierman exiting a door and allowing protesters to enter the building, which was and still is closed to the public due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Armed protesters stormed the hallway of the building, but were met by state troopers who were able to force the crowd back outside. Last week, a video posted on YouTube that appeared to show Nierman coaching constituents on how to text him so they could get into the closed Capitol just days prior to the December protest. Following the release of that video, House Speaker Tina Kotek revoked Nierman's committee assignments, fined him $2,000 for damages done to the Capitol, and called for his immediate resignation. Nierman is charged with criminal trespass and official misconduct, while spokespeople from yesterday's special committee noted that he disregarded the rule of law and the basic principles that democratic institutions are built upon. During last night's House session, Nierman was defiant on the House floor before the vote, arguing he was a victim of summary judgment and that the closure of the Capitol to the public is unconstitutional. Railing against the Democratic majority, Nierman said, quote, "There's no reason to hear both sides and have something resemble due process. The party in power doesn't have to be fair. Might makes right," unquote. However, it was not just Democrats who voted to expel him, as all his Republican colleagues did as well. On Monday, 22 House Republicans signed a letter to Nierman urging the lawmaker to resign or face possible expulsion. In the final vote of 59-1, only Nierman himself voted against the decision to expel him. Nierman's expulsion takes effect immediately, and the former lawmaker will be replaced by a Republican selected by county commissioners, likely within the next few months. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The Department of Justice launched an investigation today into allegations that the Trump administration illegally obtained phone records from Democratic lawmakers, staff, and journalists. The New York Times revealed Thursday that under Attorneys General Jeff Sessions and William Barr, the Justice Department subpoenaed Apple for the phone data of at least 12 lawmakers and their families, including one minor. The investigation began under Attorney General Jeff Sessions in 2017. Its purpose was to find the sources of stories about connections between his associates and Russia. Senate Democratic leaders are demanding that both Jeff Sessions and William Barr testify before Congress on the issue. The DOJ internal watchdog will investigate the prior doings of its department under President Trump. Communities across Oregon must rewrite local rules to allow people to sit, lie, and rest on public property. The Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3115 Wednesday, requiring cities to follow, quote, objectively reasonable policies and allowing unhoused people to occupy public property if no other shelter is available. This bill is meant to uphold the ruling in Martin v. City of Boise, which determined criminalizing homelessness was a cruel and unusual punishment. The bill received praise from homelessness advocates who maintain that Portland is failing to meet its legal obligations. City officials, including Commissioner Dan Ryan, have complained that the new law would interfere with Portland's existing campsite cleanup program. Three top aides to Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler are leaving the administration. These are the latest in a string of departures from the office, which has seen increased turnover in recent months. Robert King is the mayor's advisor on public safety. He'll be leaving City Hall in July. Also leaving are Asina Lawrence, who oversaw the mayor's police reform initiatives, and Zach Curl, who worked on homelessness issues in the mayor's office. Less than a month ago, two other key staffers left the mayor's office, and back in December, five Black staffers left the administration. According to the Oregonian, staffers leaving the mayor's office say the increased pressure of the past year of the pandemic, ongoing racial justice protests, and increased homelessness led to the burnout. Wheeler became mayor in 2017, and since then, he's had four chiefs of staff and three different communications directors. The statue of York on Mount Tabor was vandalized, and a suspect has been named. York was the only enslaved member on the Lewis and Clark expedition and the first African-American person to cross North America to reach the Pacific. The statue appeared mysteriously in February, where the toppled statue of newspaper editor Harvey Scott once stood. Photos posted on Twitter appeared to show a middle-aged woman covering the base of the statue in purple spray paint. Portland police named 43-year-old Jeanette Grode as their main suspect. The statue was erected by an unknown community member and may not be in that spot permanently. Commissioner Carmen Rubio heads the Parks Bureau, she said in a statement, quote, "When I watched the video, I was both sad and frustrated. Frankly, it should outrage all of us, especially at a time when Portlanders are actively calling for the dismantling of systemic racism and the presence of racial justice. Portlanders must continue to call out and interrupt racist actions because not doing so demeans us all, and there are real spiritual costs to our community." Clackamas County is poised to enter low-risk COVID restrictions at long last. Governor Brown said today that the county is expected to pass the 65% vaccination rate later today, and as soon as they do, they can move from high to low risk. That means less restrictions on capacity for bars, restaurants, theaters, and gyms. Counties are moved to the low-risk level when they reach a 65% vaccination rate and when they submit a vaccine equity plan to the state. The Oregon Health Authority says about 93,000 more Oregonians need to get their vaccine doses before the state reaches a 70% vaccination rate. At that point, Governor Brown is committed to lifting most COVID restrictions across the state, including lifting mask requirements. On Thursday, the state reported 370 new and presumptive cases of coronavirus and 10 new deaths. 2,726 Oregonians have died from the disease. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced it will hold an emergency meeting next week to discuss the, quote, imbalance of young men who experience heart inflammation after getting their second dose of a COVID vaccine. The CDC has identified 226 cases of heart inflammation, not exclusive to young men, but the vast majority have recovered. Advisors will hold their emergency meeting on the 18th. In national news today, Biden purchases vaccines for other countries. Congress nears a compromise on the infrastructure bill. Representative Ilhan Omar draws new criticisms and apprehensions at the border reach a 20-year high. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
As long as the virus rages elsewhere, there's a risk of new mutations that could threaten our people.
President Joe Biden said the U.S. will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to give to other nations. He made the announcement during his first overseas trip after meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
We affirmed the special relationship, as is not said lightly, the special relationship between our people, and renewed our commitment to defending the enduring democratic values that both our nations share.
Today, Biden meets other world leaders at the first day of the G7 summit. Back here in the States, a bipartisan group of senators says it's close to sealing the deal on an infrastructure plan. It would reportedly include less than the $1 trillion in new spending Biden proposes and would not raise taxes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is trying to calm tensions after several Jewish members of Congress accused Representative Ilhan Omar of likening the U.S. and Israel to Hamas and the Taliban. The comments in question were made during a hearing when Omar said she had not seen evidence domestic courts can and will prosecute alleged war crimes in Palestine and Afghanistan.
I would emphasize that in Israel and Palestine, this includes crimes committed by both the Israeli security forces and Hamas. In Afghanistan, it includes crimes committed by the Afghan national government and the Taliban.
A dozen lawmakers accused Omar of giving cover to terrorist groups. In response, Omar accused them of Islamophobia. Omar later clarified her original comments were not a moral comparison and were not equating terrorist groups with democratic countries. Pelosi and top Democrats released a statement rebuking Omar for her original comments and thanking her for the clarification. A son of Pakistani immigrants has been confirmed as the first Muslim American federal judge in U.S. history. The Senate approves Zahid Qureshi for the U.S. District Court for the District of New Jersey. The number of undocumented migrants reaching the U.S. border with Mexico hit its highest level in two decades. 180,000 migrants were apprehended in May, the largest number since April 2000. During a House hearing, David Chahoulian with the Department of Homeland Security reiterated the Biden administration's strategy.
We must deal with the factors that cause people to flee in the first place, including the ongoing violence, corruption, natural disasters, and lack of basic opportunities that plague various countries in the region. We must also provide alternative lawful avenues for migration and for finding other forms of safety in the region.
Texas Representative Henry Cuellar wants President Biden and Vice President Harris to visit his district on the southern border. The Democrats calling for concrete action, noting people from more than 150 countries came into the U.S. last month.
You're going to have people from other countries that are going to say, hey, all we have to do is bring a child and we'll be able to come in. And I wish that the administration would understand that that has an impact on our local communities.
Republicans have blamed Biden's policies for the border surge. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race, then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight's weather will be gray and rainy, high 50s and low 60s in the forecast. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy, with our high in the 70s. Today, in 1963, President John F. Kennedy proposed the Civil Rights Act, which prohibited discrimination based on race, religion, or sex. The quote of the day is from former President Lyndon B. Johnson. He said, quote, "Until justice is blind to color, until education is unaware of race, until opportunity is unconcerned with the color of men's skins, emancipation will be a proclamation, but not a fact." Month marks 40 years since the first cases of HIV were reported. Advocacy group Equality California commemorated the occasion. With more on the story, it's Suzanne Potter.
40 years ago this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported the first cases of what would become known as HIV/AIDS and touch off an epidemic that took 32 million lives across the globe and 700,000 in the United States. Rick Chavez-Spur is executive director of the nonprofit Equality California, a job he's about to leave to run for state assembly. He says Americans mustn't forget the terrible toll of this disease.
I lost literally scores of friends to the disease and watched our government pretty much do nothing about it for over a decade. And so as I think about the 40th anniversary, I think we need to remember all the people that were lost.
He adds the huge loss of life and perceived inaction by the Reagan administration motivated groups like Equality California to help elect leaders who would take the disease seriously, including President Bill Clinton and Senators Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. Today, HIV treatments make it possible for 38 million people worldwide to live with HIV, including 1.2 million Americans. Chavez-Spur says he's proud of the leading role California has played in making new medications more accessible.
California is one of the few states that insurance fully covers PEP and PrEP and Medi-Cal, and that's not the case across the country, so we need to reduce the barriers for medication that can prevent HIV.
Advocates would also like to see the repeal of laws in multiple states that criminalize the transmission of or perceived exposure to HIV and other infectious diseases, arguing that these laws serve as a major disincentive for people to get tested. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Nearly 20 inmates have died in tribal jails since 2016. According to a recent investigation, many of these facilities violated federal law by providing inadequate medical care. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. 19 people have died at tribal jails overseen by the federal government since 2016. That's according to a new investigation from NPR and the Mountain West News Bureau. It uncovered a pattern of mismanagement and neglect. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports.
The investigation found that guards at several detention centers violated federal policy that requires regular checks on inmates and the provision of proper medical care. In one instance, a 22-year-old man died in a holding cell. His body wasn't discovered for nearly 3 hours. And unlike other federal correctional facilities, the investigation revealed that Bureau of Indian Affairs jails do not require on-site nurses or doctors. Brandy Tomhave, a tribal advocate and member of the Choctaw Nation, says the federal government has known about these problems for years, but has done very little about it.
And that decision has gotten people killed.
The Interior Department says it plans to launch a review of the jails. For National Native News, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Following indigenous-led protests earlier this week over the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota, a group of Native American contractors is calling for an end to those actions. The Star Tribune reports six contractors sent a letter to Minnesota tribal leaders criticizing the protests for disrupting work, damaging property, and threatening employees. They noted the protesters, quote, intentionally create a false narrative that there is no Native American support for this project and the economic impacts and opportunities it brings to our people. Thousands of protesters marched near the Mississippi River headwaters last weekend and occupied a pump station construction site. They also locked themselves to equipment and blocked a road. Enbridge, which is building the pipeline, said it evacuated 44 employees. 10 of those worked for Gordon Construction, a company based on the White Earth Reservation. Owner Matt Gordon is one of the signatories to the letter. The Star Tribune reports the White Earth, Red Lake, and Mille Lacs bands have opposed the Enbridge pipeline, but the Fond du Lac band of Lake Superior Chippewa dropped its opposition and made a deal with Enbridge to allow the new Line 3 on its land. The Leech Lake band of Ojibwe supported the new pipeline to get an older Line 3 removed from its land. According to a report Enbridge filed with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, the company has spent $200 million on contracts related to the project with tribal businesses in Minnesota and $22 million on wages to indigenous workers in the state. But White Earth band member Winona LaDuke, who leads the group Honor the Earth, accused Enbridge of using Native people as a smokescreen to destroy the environment. Chief Leonard Crow Dog, the Sikonju Lakota leader who helped revitalize Native American religion and was a leader for indigenous rights, died on June 6th at the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. He was 78. Native News Online reports Chief Crow Dog came from a line of Lakota medicine men and was educated by his parents and elders in the Rosebud Sioux tribe. He kept traditional knowledge alive for his tribe and told his story in the book Crow Dog, Four Generations of Indian Medicine Men. President of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and Chief Crow Dog's cousin, Rodney Bordeaux, said Crow Dog helped bring back the Sun Dance, which had been outlawed. He was also the spiritual leader for the American Indian movement. Chief Crow Dog remained a spiritual leader and elder for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe until the end of his life in a 2016 ceremony at Standing Rock, where veterans apologized for the harm they and the United States caused to Native Americans. He granted forgiveness. In May of this year, he once more advocated for the reclamation of the Black Hills at a gathering of Sioux tribes. Chief Crow Dog was buried on June 7th following traditional Lakota services at Chief Crow Dog's Paradise near Rosebud, South Dakota. Flags are flying at half staff all week in his honor. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
States are in the process of redistricting across the country since the 2020 census brought new demographic data. In New Mexico, the committee tasked with redrawing electoral districts faces criticism for not representing the diversity of the state. Roz Brown has more on the story.
New Mexico is considered one of the 10 most ethnically diverse states, but its new redistricting committee is anything but. Using 2020 census data, the 7-member committee will redraw electoral district boundaries for the U.S. House, legislature, and the Public Education Commission. Kathleen Burke with the group Fair Districts for New Mexico says 30 of the 69 people who applied were women, but only one was selected. She says women, along with people of color and rural residents, will need to rely on committee members to keep the discussions fair.
There definitely needs to be strong Native American voices, and there needs to be rural voices. And so we have asked them to include that in their work plan. How are you going to accomplish that?
The panel includes 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, and 3 Independents, but no Indigenous, Black, or Asian members. A representative for Common Cause New Mexico said this week that redistricting advocates will push for a constitutional amendment to the Redistricting Act to ensure greater regional, ethnic, and gender diversity on future committees. After working as a community organizer for 2 decades, Amber Carrillo, who now heads the All Pueblo Council of Governors, applied for the commission but wasn't selected. She says Indigenous people are vital to the state's success.
You can just look to New Mexico for any number of things, and you'll see our handprint. Our cottage industry artisans contribute tremendously to the tourism industry of New Mexico, which is the leading industry.
Carrillo says given the political gains that women, and particularly Native American women, have made in recent years, the committee's composition is disappointing.
And I am hopeful that we will find some redress for the lack of diversity on this important committee by way of our political leaders coming forward and offering some suggestions.
According to the guidelines set up by the legislature, the State Ethics Commission was tasked with choosing 3 members, while some individual legislators picked 1 apiece, but they were not required to coordinate their selections. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Many state legislatures are tackling the issue of climate resilience in a variety of ways. The Pennsylvania State Senate, however, is considering a bill that would limit the ability of local governments to restrict the use of methane gas or promote energy efficiency. With more on the story, we go to Michaela Savitt.
A gas preemption bill in the state Senate would prevent Pennsylvania municipalities from adopting policies that would restrict or prohibit methane gas use in new homes and buildings in favor of using electricity. Critics of the measure say it could especially hurt areas like Bethlehem, which has its own climate plan and has reduced municipal greenhouse gas emissions by 37% from 2005 to 2017. Robert Ruth with the Clean Air Council says the bill would hinder local communities' clean energy goals.
The bill, as currently written, is overbroad, and it has the potential to chill any municipal efforts to, say, adopt new energy efficiency measures, or even to offer financial incentives to developers to pursue all-electric construction for new buildings.
Senate Bill 275 is still in committee, but Ruth believes with the state's deep ties to the gas industry, it's likely the bill will pass or be included in the budget as an amendment. Appliances that use fossil fuel energy sources account for 11% of greenhouse gas emissions in Pennsylvania, according to the Department of Environmental Protection. Logan Weldy, also with the Clean Air Council, thinks the policy could halt progress curbing emissions.
If we can't reduce the amount of gas that we're pulling out of the ground, transporting, and burning, we are not going to be on track to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that we really have to do.
A 2021 DEP climate change impact assessment estimates the state is on course for a 6-degree temperature increase by mid-century. Rachel Golden with the Sierra Club's Clean Buildings Campaign notes the Senate bill is part of a trend her organization is seeing in the U.S.
The gas industry has seen this momentum, and they feel it is an existential threat to their business model. It's important to understand that the gas industry's main revenue source from delivering gas to end users is to homes and buildings.
She points out that homes and buildings account for 94% of gas industry revenue in Pennsylvania, higher than the national average of 87%. For Keystone State News Connection, I'm Michaela Savitt.
Since the pandemic, food insecurity has been a growing problem for families who rely on school lunch programs. Some Utah residents hope the Biden administration's American Families Plan could help provide rural Utah families with a budget for food during the summer break. Mark Richardson has the story.
Food insecurity among rural Utah children, already a problem prior to the pandemic, has grown worse in the past 15 months. Children's advocates say while free and low-cost school lunch programs help feed thousands of Utah kids each year, a Biden administration proposal could permanently expand these nutrition programs, particularly outside of Utah's urban school districts. The multi-billion-dollar American Families Plan would provide direct payments to families to cover kids' meals during the summer break. Neil Ricard with the group Utahns Against Hunger says the plan would close a major gap in current food programs.
The thing about summer meals in Utah is that we are a fairly rural state. Most of the state is not an urban area. And while districts do a great job of providing summer meals while they're available, there are still a lot of places that are just never going to be fully accessible for summer meals.
The program would provide eligible families $300 or more a month during summer break for groceries. It also includes tax credits and improvements to education, child care, jobless benefits, and paid leave, but many Republicans oppose the plan's hefty price tag. Ricard says in more than 60% of rural Utah households, both parents work, meaning their kids can't always participate in summer meal programs.
A lot of the time there are limited time frames where those summer meal sites can be accessible. And also, just because you're in a rural area, a significant distance away from where parents might be in a place to access them. We love the summer meals program. It just doesn't fully address some of the needs that we have here in Utah.
Ricard predicts in Utah, childhood hunger will still be a problem in the coming years.
I would love dearly to see like our recovery, a bounce back after the pandemic that even ate into these existing rates of food insecurity. But frankly, this was a problem prior to the pandemic and will continue to be one.
The Biden administration touts the American Families Plan paired with the American Jobs Plan as a post-pandemic effort to rebuild the country's physical infrastructure and workforce. Congress has not yet begun to debate the plans. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 11th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, the producer is Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mark Richardson, Suzanne Potter, Michaela Savitt, Roz Brown, Mary Sherman, and Megan Kamrick. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself. On the move.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, employees of Whole Foods, owned by the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, were asked to give their own accrued paid sick days to coworkers who had either contributed